For the week of January 17th, 2016, this is Showbiz Sandbox 308, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
How you doing, Michael?
I'm all right. I didn't get an Oscar nomination, but I'm going to be okay.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of people didn't get Oscar nominations.
Including black people.
Yes, well, okay, that's one way of looking at it. Yes, that was kind of the big news of the week. That, and of course, we covered this last week, David Bowie passing away. We covered that last week. We're not going to cover it this week, but...
We are, in a way.
We are? Oh, well, that's true. We kind of are during Big Deal or Big Whoop. That's true.
What else will we talk about?
Well, you know, Michael, besides David Bowie and the Oscars, I was thinking, wow, there's really nothing happening this week. And sometimes when you have two big stories, there creates a news vacuum. And lo and behold, the entertainment news gods kind of shined on us because last night when we were putting the show together, we were kind of thinking, okay, what are we putting inside baseball? And we didn't know what to put in Inside Baseball, which is our segment where we discuss the entertainment news headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing, right? That they might be talked about inside Hollywood or inside the industry. And we decided, okay, let's put Netflix there. We wake up in the morning, both on the front page of the New York Times and the LA Times, there are these big news stories about how Netflix is riling the entertainment industry.
Well, and that's part of the fact that you've had a week where all the TV networks are meeting with journalists to talk about all their new shows and announcing, you know, renewals and new shows and pilots and revivals and things like that. So there's a lot of news coming out of TV.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, studios are worried Netflix is getting too big and whether they have created a monster. TV networks are angry that Netflix can claim to be a success but never reveal their ratings. Are they creating an illusion or a new business model? And Netflix is concerned about viewers who live in one country but pay for service from another, usually the U.S., actually, especially since they just turned on the lights in an extra 130 territories and are ready for business. We talked about
that. And your credit card.
That's right. Is it a coincidence that now they announce that they're ready to smack down, you know, they're opening in all these countries and they're going to smack down on all these illegal users? I don't think so. And do they really want to succeed? We'll cover it all, as I mentioned, during Inside Baseball. Naturally, we also break down the Oscar nominations and this year's controversy, as we also mentioned the Lily White Oscar nominations, which have prompted calls for a boycott by Spike Lee and Jada Pinkett Smith. The color that really matters is gold, and we don't mean a gold statuette. We mean gold at the box office. Which movies are capitalizing on Oscar and why? Of course, we cover the week's big entertainment news during Big Deal or Big Whoop, but first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're talking about box office around the world. We pull our information from RentTrak. We have a link in our show notes. We also look at box office profits and Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, the New York Times, you name it. Anywhere we can find out info on movies making money around the world, including Hungary. And this week, the number one film around the world is Star Wars: The Force Awakens. Another $72 million, $1.8 billion worldwide, $1,863 million and counting. It still has its sights on Titanic. It's not going to be easy. It will cross $2 billion. It will be the third film in history to do that. It looks like Avatar is falling far away and is not going to get there. And why is that? Is that because a friend of mine was looking at how quickly this movie made money? He said, hey, look how many weeks Avatar made money week after week after week. And certainly Titanic did that in spades. They both started smaller and just chugged along, making 10, 15 million for weeks and weeks and weeks. Star Wars made its money really quick.
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, Titanic was a different time. It was 20 years ago.
Okay? Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're always comparing movies in different eras. It's hard. And that's right. And so those movies have legs because they're not able to make $300 million on opening weekend.
Right. Well, and I also think that between Star Wars and Avatar, I think with Avatar, you had the, oh my goodness, it's 3D done right for the first time ever. And oh, by the way, when it comes out—
Not for the first time ever. There have been cool 3D movies before that.
You're right. But in this new era of 3D, it's done correctly. So you're right.
It was a spectacle. People had to see it. But the question is, did 20 million people go see Avatar five times or did— You know, 80 million people just see Star Wars once. Are we talking about a movie that people didn't like as much, it didn't go back to again and again? Or is that just not happening in this new era because they know in a few weeks it's going to be on Blu-ray?
I think the latter. And I think with Star Wars, you don't need to see it in 3D. I think, you know, for the most part...
No one's talking about 3D.
No, meaning that I think a lot of people went to see Avatar who wouldn't normally go to see a movie like Avatar. They'd go because I have to see it in the theater because that's when it's going to be in 3D. When I get it on Blu-ray or DVD, well, it's not going to be the same movie. With Star Wars, if I don't see it in the movie theater, I'll see it on home video when it comes out. It's going to be the same movie.
Well, I think there was repeat business for Star Wars. I think people still go see movies again and again. I think they just do it within like 2 weeks rather than over 2 or 3 months. So I think there is repeat business. I don't think it's a fact that they saw Star Wars and said, I don't like it. So I don't think it was that it was less popular or didn't have legs because somehow people weren't enjoying it as much. Probably there was a little bit more repeat business for Avatar, but I guess we won't know without some figures from the studio saying, hey, look, we did a poll and, you know, 10% of the audience saw the movies 5 times, you know, for Avatar, whereas that didn't happen for Star Wars. I think obviously once you're talking $2 billion worldwide, you're very popular. But it's true. They make money a lot quicker. And that probably depresses repeat viewing because it's not in theaters for 6 months. You know, you don't want to see it as much a week later as you might 2 months later.
True. And I think that, you know, Avatar was released by 20th Century Fox, the same studio that released the first 6 Star Wars movies. And if they had released this one, they'd be more than happy to do that study for you. But they didn't. Disney did.
At number 2 around the world is The Revenant, Leonardo DiCaprio's Western, $61 million worldwide, $150 million and counting. This may be the movie that's capitalizing the most on Oscar momentum. And number 3 around the world is Ride Along 2, the Kevin Hart Ice Cube movie. Ice Cube's movie Straight Outta Compton did not get an Oscar nomination for Best Picture. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But Ride Along 2 is a hit, $42 million over the weekend worldwide. And number 4 is Daddy's Home, the Will Ferrell, Mark Wahlberg comedy. $17 million over the weekend, $180 million worldwide. That clearly will pass the $200 million mark, but probably not much more beyond that. And number 5 is Michael Bay's 13 Hours, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi. Hillary Clinton has nothing to worry about. It opened to $16 million, a decent number, but nothing near what Clint Eastwood's movie did last year or the year before. Some movies that appeal to a heartland audience. But it's a solid, decent, okay opening. It costs $50 million to make. We'll have to see where it ends up. But it had an okay beginning. And number 6 is their first Chinese film on the list. It's Boonie Bears 3.
I never saw Boonie Bears 2 or 1.
Well, we've talked about this series before. It's based on a TV show. It's kind of sounds like a Yogi Bear thing. It's a couple bears in the woods, and their arch rival is a logger, and they always have to outsmart him and keep him from cutting down the trees in their forest. You'd think he'd lose his job eventually, but it hasn't happened yet. They made $60 million over the weekend. I guess this movie opened on a Wednesday. It's now at $21 million and counting. This is a very cheap, low-budget movie. It's a spinoff of a TV show. They're not spending a lot of money on it. And that's why they're up to Boonie Bears 3, because they keep the costs low. They churn it out. It's a very popular TV show. I think it's still going on in China. And they're making a dime, but it is not one of those movies that is going to break out worldwide or advance the art of animation. And number 7 is Creed, another movie that... its Oscar nomination was for the white actor Sylvester Stallone and a gay white male and his female white partner who wrote the screenplay. That's where Creed got recognized. And yet it's a box office success, $15 million over the weekend, $135 million worldwide. And number 8 is The Big Short, another movie that's doing the best job of capitalizing on Oscar. It made $12 million over the weekend. It's at $68 million and counting. It's just starting its overseas campaign. We'll have to see how much people around the world care about Wall Street and the shenanigans that went on for the big recession.
Or can even understand it, even if Morgan Fairchild is explaining it to you from a bathtub.
Morgan Fairchild? Was it really Morgan Fairchild?
I think so. I mean, I believe it was Morgan Fairchild in a bathtub explaining, and then Selena Gomez.
Morgan Fairchild from the days of, like, the primetime soaps?
I think so, yeah. If I'm not mistaken, that's who that was, right?
You might want to look that up. I mean, I haven't seen the movie yet. I didn't realize Morgan Fairchild was in it. I thought it was someone else. At number 9 is Royal Treasure. This is a movie I can't figure out. There is a series of movies from Nigeria, also known as Nollywood, called Royal Treasure. They're up to number 3 or 4. That's not this. I assume this is a South Korean or a Chinese movie. It's opened in one territory from the distributor. It looks like it's probably Chinese, but I couldn't figure out the movie, the property, the franchise, what it is. But whatever it is, it made $11 million over the weekend. And if you know what Royal Treasure is, my God, contact us, right, Sperling?
I agree. You can contact us at dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888 888- 567 SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And I loved the way you foreshadowed earlier about an email we plan on reading later in the show from Hungary.
Well, I hope you've got more info on that, because I couldn't access the actual article. I found it only in Hungarian. At number 10 around the world is The Hateful Eight, Quentin Tarantino's movie. It made $11 million over the weekend. It's at $77 million worldwide. Ennio Morricone, I'm rooting for him. And skipping down the list, we see The Fifth Wave. This is a young adult series of novels by Rick Yancey, very popular, but of course, yet another young adult novel about dystopian future with a young female heroine and in love with two guys who both want her and she has to save the world. It began its campaign overseas. It opened in 30 territories. It made $8 million. The reviews from the trades have been meh, so we'll have to see how it does in the U.S. There are popular books. We'll have to see if there's enough of an audience to give this a jump start at the box office once it hits North America. And way down towards the bottom is Norma the North, an animated film that opened up here in the U.S. This has one of the worst reviews totals I've seen in a while. This really got pilloried by the critics. It grossed $6 million over the weekend. Not a success story for Rob Schneider, but of course it only costs $18 million to make, so they may be laughing all the way to the bank.
And you know what? I can't find Morgan Fairchild in the credits of The Big Short, so maybe I was wrong.
I believe it's a Morgan Fairchild is a very smart, very sexy woman. I think it's some obnoxious Hollywood exec would have said, give me a younger Morgan Fairchild. I think it was some young hottie. Morgan Fairchild is a mature hottie.
Yes, and I want a Morgan Fairchild that meets Heather Locklear. That's, give me one of those younger ones.
But 20.
Yeah. But 20. Make it 18.
God forbid. I'd love to see Morgan Fairchild in a bathtub explaining economics to us, and she probably could do it.
That's probably true.
I once saw her on Nightline, and she was a very smart, savvy person talking about the AIDS crisis with Ted Koppel on Nightline, and I was really impressed by her knowledge and her preparation. She's a smart, interesting woman.
Well, now, you were talking about Star Wars box office, and a while back...
Oh, this is fascinating, yeah.
We were talking about, like, well, how much money could Star Wars possibly make in Japan?
Well, it helps if they let you actually stay in the theaters. First of all, they made this movie wait till January because they wanted the holidays to themselves. And now apparently they're yanking it off screens after less than a week. Right? It opened up last Saturday, and already they're cutting down on the screens that the movie's playing. It's made $95 million since opening January 9th.
Okay, you're talking about China now. I just said Japan, but okay. So
I'm sorry.
You're talking about China, but no, keep going because this is interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And they've already, we thought, all right, it's got a month before... it's got some more big competition. We'll have to see where it ends up. But in a month is plenty of time to make a lot of money, but not when they yank your screens. Apparently, they've cut down on the screens already in China. So, they're cutting the legs out from under it.
Yeah.
This has to infuriate Disney.
I would imagine it does. And it's going to become more and more onerous to do business in China if you cannot guarantee
a decent run.
I mean, you can't guarantee box office, right? No,
you can guarantee you won't screw a movie over, though. You can certainly guarantee you won't say, oh, you're making money, and we just took away 70% of your screens. Now, I don't know how many screens they've taken off. All it says is it's been bumped off, quote, a large number of screens this weekend to make way for Chinese movies. That's just what one of the trades says. Now it's at $95 million. They say it could top out at $150 million, whereas, since it opened up so strongly, you would have thought it could make $200 million or more easily.
And what I love is that this is a country that is buying into Hollywood. As we mentioned last week, the Wanda Group bought the majority stake in Legendary Entertainment for $3.5 billion, by the way. And,
You got to have good relations. It's going to be harder and harder to make deals and get people angry. But you know what? Bullies get away with it until you fight back.
Right. And I guess
they don't pay a price. You want to be there, and you're like, oh, what are we going to do?
And this is a constant conversation at CinemaCon every year when Chris Dodd sits up there with John Fithian from the National Association of Theater Owners and Chris Dodd is from the Motion Picture Association of America. And one of the first questions is always about China. And, hey, remember when you let them into the World Trade Organization and now they're not actually following the rules here for, actual free trade? Remember that? Okay, what are you going to do about that, Mr. Dodd? There's like no answer because it's like, what can he do? I mean, even if he complains vociferously, which he has, and he has actually made some serious headway with China, it's like he can only control so much.
But when you have a movie this big getting its legs cut out from under it, that really grabs attention, I think.
I think you're absolutely right. I think when it's a smaller film that not a lot of people have their eyes on.
Or you're just fiddling with release date, but, you know, yanking screens away from a hit.
It becomes more obvious when it happens this way. That's for sure.
It's less obvious in Japan. They're not meddling with the film, are they? And Star Wars is doing very well, but it's not an actual phenomenon, is it?
No, and it looks that, $100 million it will make in Japan when it's done. They think it's going to top out at around $100 million.
Mm-hmm. And which is great, but Frozen,
$250 million.
I mean, that's just one of the all-time big hits, but that's what you expected from Star Wars, isn't it?
Yes, and Force Awakens passed the 7 billion yen or $60 million mark in 20 days in Japanese cinemas, which was 3 days faster than Frozen, but Frozen went on to make $250 million. So they're not thinking that that's going to happen with Force Awakens.
Well, in 2 weeks, we've got Kung Fu Panda 3 opening. That will be in China. And that looks like a more big competition for Star Wars there. The trade reviews have been great for this movie.
I was shocked.
And let's point it out. I think Hollywood Reporter said, you know what? This is a movie you should see in 3D. Animation,
yes.
You can do really well in 3D. It lends itself to that. And they've given it their stamp of, it's been a while since I've seen a movie where a review said, you know what? You need to see this in 3D. So I will.
Yeah. And actually, it does not surprise me that it would be a DreamWorks Animation film wherein you should see it in 3D because, of course, Jeffrey Katzenberg, the head of DreamWorks Animation, was a big proponent of 3D.
Well, the important thing is to do it right, and apparently that's what they've done this time. And this week, opening up is Dirty Grandpa with Zac Efron and Robert De Niro as the titular character, that dirty, foul-mouthed grandfather. And our friend Aaron Rich saw it and said it was great. I had no expectations for this movie, but he said it's hilarious, so I'm looking forward.
I could have sworn, you know, that you just said Zac Efron and Robert De Niro in the same movie, but I must have misheard you. So who's in that again?
Excuse me, I liked High School Musical.
Okay, but no, I mean, I think Zac Efron is a fine young
actor.
Shut up,
you don't need to kowtow to Zac Efron. He's doing just fine without you. Someday he'll probably get an Oscar nomination, and those nominations came out this week, right? And we've learned a lot, haven't we, Sperling?
We have learned a lot. What exactly did we learn? I know that most people are going to say, well, what do you mean? Of course, we learned that there's, you know, a lack of diversity in Hollywood. That's what we learned, but we already knew that, so it's not like we learned it.
That's true. Well, we learned I was wrong yet again.
What?
I would have bet money that there would be nine. I think I would have drawn the line at 8 films, but I was pretty confident there would be 9 or 10 nominations. I felt like the field was so wide open that this was a year where we'd get 9 or 10. But in fact, we only got 8 movies nominated for Best Picture, meaning some flicks that looked like locks, like Carol, the Todd Haynes film, didn't make the cut.
Not only did Carol not get nominated for Best Picture, but of course, Best Director, it did not get
nominated. Oh, no, it got lots of nominations, but it did not get one of the slots for Best Picture. I would have bet 9 or 10. I don't think I would have laid money down. I definitely would have said more than 7. So I guess I'm going to give myself credit and say I would have not, you know, actually wagered bucks on it. But I thought we'd see 9 or 10, and we didn't. We only saw 8, so I was wrong about that.
And who distributed Carol? Is that a Weinstein film?
The Weinsteins have no movie up for Best Picture this year. It's the first time practically in like 15 years or something that they're not up for Best Picture. They had The Hateful Eight, and I believe Carol was theirs as well in the running, and they were hoping to be in the mix, and it didn't happen. So I don't know what Harvey's going to do.
Just a quick side note here, okay? Have you seen Hateful Eight?
No, I have not.
Because I went to see the 70mm Roadshow. I specifically chose to see it 3 to 4 sure. weeks after it was released. I went to see it at the Landmark Theater, one of 2 theaters here in the Los Angeles area where it is showing on 70mm.
Were there scratches on the print?
Oh, my God. Scratches on the print. It was bouncing. The registration, which is where, you know, in the gate, was all over the place.
Well, they have no experience anymore. You know, it was really hard.
It was letterboxed, okay? So the bottom of the screen was letterboxed. And it began with an opening remark.
Overture.
But even before that, the usher came out and said, you know, here's what's going to happen. And oh, by the way, this is being projected on 70mm film, so it's going to look a little wonky. And I thought, really? We all know it's going to be 70mm. That's why we're all here. And then they show this film on a screen that is, you know, a regular size screen. It's not this big giant Cinerama screen. There was no reason whatsoever this film should have been projected in 70mm.
Well, why not? I mean, if it's done right, it just doesn't sound like it was done right at that theater.
Yeah, okay. All right, fine. But, you know, moving back.
Of course it should be shot in 7mm. It was meant to be seen in 70mm.
Shot in 70mm.
I mean, it was developed to be shown in 70mm. Why shouldn't it be? It's not like they took a regular movie and blew it up to 70mm. Of course it should be shown in 70mm.
All right, fine.
You schmuck. So, yes.
You think you're the first person to ever call me a schmuck?
Probably not.
Exactly.
So, of course, the big story out of the Oscar nominations is the lack of diversity, especially in the acting awards. The second year in a row, all white, all lily white. And people are frankly embarrassed. No black, no Hispanic, no Asian. Women outside of acting got the short shaft. At least we notice in CARE now, right? I suppose that's a sense of progress, right? Every year we go, look at the lack of diversity.
Well, right. Will Packer, the producer of Straight Outta Compton, actually used the word embarrassing. He said and this is a quote, he said, "The reason the rest of the world looks at us like we have no clue is because in 2016, it's a complete embarrassment to say that the heights of cinematic achievement have only been reached by white people. I repeat, it's embarrassing."
There's more diversity on the Oscar TV show than there is at the Oscar nominations. You've got Chris Rock as the host. You've got Reginald Hudlin as one of the producers. So they're doing a better job on the show and the things they can actually control than the nominations, which are out of their hands.
Speaking of what's out of their hands, I wonder if, Chris Rock calling the Oscars the white BET awards.
That's very funny.
I think that maybe Chris Rock is out of their control.
No, that's not out of control. It's funny. It's what
they
hire him for.
Yeah.
He's funny. He's not there, he's speaking his mind.
I think he said,
amusing. It doesn't hurt anybody's feelings. It's an amusing observation.
I think he said, watch the Academy Awards. I may curse.
Spike Lee said what I was about to say. As soon as people talked about, look at the nominations, my immediate thought is, well, look at the movies that they're making, because that's the real problem. The more good movies there are with people of color in front of the camera, the more chances there are for movies to get nominated. We can name the movies this year that got overlooked. Creed, Straight Outta Compton, Beasts of No Nation, Chi-Raq, Concussion with Will Smith. But the fact is, you can make arguments for or against each of those movies. And what you need is a lot more movies being made with women in front of the camera and behind the camera with black, Hispanic, and Asian stars. And Spike Lee said, quote, "As I see it, the Academy Awards is not where the real battle is. It's in the executive office of the Hollywood studios and TV and cable networks. This is where the gatekeepers decide what gets made and what gets jettisoned to turn around a scrap heap. This is what's important. The gatekeepers, those with the green light vote. As the great actor Leslie Odom Jr. sings and dances in the game-changing Broadway musical Hamilton, I want to be in the room where it happens. People, the truth is we ain't in those rooms, and until minorities are, the Oscar nominees will remain lily white."
And I have to say, that song in Hamilton, fantastic. It's one of the highlights of the show.
It is, absolutely. And Spike Lee's right. Nonetheless, he and Jada Pinkett Smith are sort of leading a call to say, hey, we should boycott this. This is ridiculous. Spike just received a career award from the Oscars, but he's not going to the ceremony.
Wow, okay. Well, I think the Governor's awards were already held, so I think he already picked it up, didn't he?
No, yeah, he already got his career award, yes, at that ceremony. But he's saying, he goes almost every year. I imagine this year he said, "I'm not going."
I don't know if he goes every year.
Of course, his movie was one of the movies not nominated, but I don't think that is a quid pro quo thing. He's, I think it's just the general tenor of the awards. One can say Chi-Raq, you weren't even clear that it was not released in theaters, were you?
Correct. And that's, I think, we talked about this right before we began the show, whether it took some time before Netflix television shows and television series, I can't speak today, were nominated for Emmy Awards, right? Because
that's why they had their own Cable Ace Awards, because cable shows didn't get nominated. And then streaming shows actually pretty quickly got nominated. But
right. Anyway. And I think the same is going to be true of Netflix movies.
They got two Oscar nominations for Best Documentary, didn't they?
But documentaries were always shown on television. And that particular branch, the documentary branch, is used to a documentary showing in a theater that nobody's heard of before, or they've heard of, but it's like inaccessible for most of the people to see it. And then it immediately goes to PBS or some television network. That's kind of tradition. Whereas I think in this case, I don't necessarily know there was pushback because it was Netflix. I just think there was a perception of, oh, is that a movie? I thought it was a television movie. It's not. You mean it was like a movie that we could vote for? I didn't know
that. And
people
were outraged that Idris Elba did not get nominated for Beast of No Nation, right?
Right, correct. However, you pointed something out that was very interesting, that theatrically the movie only made $90,000.
That's right. It's a very low visibility movie. But you said people are like, oh, that movie with Idris Elba, that Netflix thing. Why wasn't he nominated?
Yeah, and that Netflix like, show. How come the Netflix
then,
show wasn't nominated?
And then you'd say, did you see it?
No.
Right.
Exactly.
And then no, I haven't. So it's like, you know, hey, go see the movie. That's the best way to support it. And if people go see the movies, if they go see Chi-Raq, which made a couple million dollars, but frankly should have done better. It got pretty good reviews. Beast of No Nation. Maybe it did great numbers on Netflix, but it certainly wasn't a success at the box office. But the best way to guarantee your movie stays in the conversation is to actually support it by going to see it.
Well, right. And so there's a perception issue here, one that we will be talking about a little later on in the show. Okay?
I thought we were talking about it right now.
Well, that it's a Netflix show, okay, not a Netflix movie.
Well, so I don't think people are actually confused about that. People know it was not eligible for the Oscars, but not a lot of people saw it. If people
yeah,
don't
true.
Go see it, it's not a hit, and it wasn't very well reviewed. Everybody liked Idris Elba, and
right.
he could potentially receive an Oscar nomination. But this was not a commercial hit, nor was it a big success from critics. People respected it, but they didn't love it.
And really, I would like to point out Spotlight. Okay, this is by a distributor or comes from a distributor, Open Road, which is owned by Regal and AMC, two cinema chains here in the U.S. It's their independent movie.
And there might have been a lot of resistance to that.
Yes, correct. And yet they are mounting quite the campaign for this
movie. But
they're
white.
Okay, I don't know what you want me to say about that, but...
Well, we were discussing diversity. And you're true. It's true that you're saying there could be a resistance to streaming companies getting the Oscar game. I don't think so. I think just like in TV, that barrier has fallen. You're already seeing nominations. You'll just see more as the years go on. I just think Beast of No Nation was not the movie to make that happen. But like you say, you've got two theater chains making a movie, and that's getting all sorts of attention. They almost don't want to bring attention to the fact that they're theater chains that made this movie, because frankly, I'd forgotten about that.
Right. But they're a small company, right? And Room, okay, right above it there. You got Room and Spotlight.
Well, they're small, but they're more importantly, it's two theater chains making a movie. And that could scare people back in the old days. But now there are so many players, it just doesn't matter.
Right. And remember, the Paramount decree is still a Paramount decree. Granted, it only applies to those studios that were around. I'm sorry?
They didn't break it.
No, they did not break it. No.
Right. Well, and another movie that got overlooked is Concussion with Will Smith. But again, a box office, not a success, particularly one of his lower grossing movies and not great reviews. So it's not really a shock that that movie didn't get recognized. However, Creed and Straight Outta Compton, these movies are movies where you can make an argument. Straight Outta Compton is the highest grossing musical in North American history. Obviously, we're not adjusting for inflation, but there's no question this is a monster hit. It got great reviews. It did big box office. And that's the sort of thing Oscar often likes to recognize.
Yeah, I mean, I think here is where that whole weird math thing that the Academy does, where like you can get nominated, you know, you put things in like 1 through 10, you list your favorite movies, and if it like falls on a certain level, and I don't think a lot of people put Straight Outta Compton as their number one movie, then
because they're white,
well,
not
maybe.
Because they didn't like it, but because that wasn't their first thing on their mind. I'm just
right.
saying, when the Oscar voters are lily white and they're working on diversity there, it's less a movie they're going to rush out to see. It was a big hit, but not necessarily with Oscar voters. It's younger. It's urban, by which I mean there are black actors in it. They're cursing. You know, Oscar likes its triumphant heroes, but they tend to prefer them to be sort of like sacrificial lambs. They like Norma Rae. They like Silkwood. They don't so much like guys who are cursing and singing rap music and saying, you know, the police. That's not necessarily what the 67-year-old Oscar voter is waiting to hear.
Well, and, you know,
so
the Oscar voters are becoming more diverse themselves.
Along with the studios, you got to get diversity in the Oscar voters. And slowly but surely, they're trying to get them to be younger and reflect the people who are actually making movies in Hollywood.
Well, I noticed here, as you went through the Academy Award nominations, you actually picked winners already.
Oh, sure. Why not?
Okay, so you said...
I just, in the areas where I felt like we knew what might happen.
You said that for Best Picture, it's Spotlight versus The Revenant.
And I think Spotlight will do it. Though other people seem to think Big Short is the one. You know, I've seen other people naming that as the early frontrunner. But I just feel like Spotlight is the obvious choice. Oscar often goes with the obvious choice when all is said and done. And you end up right back where you think you should.
Well, and keep in mind, last year Birdman won, right? And that was an Iñárritu film, Alejandro Iñárritu, who was nominated for Best Director. And The Revenant was nominated for Best Picture. So they may not want to kind of go to Iñárritu 2 years in a row.
Sure.
That may be the case.
But then the question is, you know, are Big Short and Spotlight the little films, and that gives The Revenant, you know, they may eat each other's audience and The Revenant gets to step in as a big commercial hit.
Were you surprised Bridge of Spies, the Spielberg film, was nominated for Best Picture?
I was nominated. I was surprised by all of its attention.
Okay. Well, Brooklyn.
I'm not really surprised by any of the other movies on the list. The most notable thing I would say is that this is a year with popular movies on it. Despite no Straight Outta Compton, despite no Star Wars, you do have
Mad Max
Fury Road, The Martian, and The Revenant, which is shaping up to be a big hit. So that's three very popular, well-known movies, and that's doesn't happen often at the Oscars, does it?
No, not at all. But
So that's a year where people who are watching the Oscars and thinking, should I watch? Oh, I saw The Martian. I love The Martian. I love Matt Damon. Mad Max, I think, was a hit and critics loved it. It doesn't have quite the same, I don't think, zeitgeisty moment as The Martian, but it's a hit. You know, not a hit in terms of its budget versus the box office, but it's a hit in sense it played in theaters and did well and people saw it and know the name and it's a big commercial movie. So that's a good year for the Oscars as far as trying to get attention for, you know, an audience, bringing them in. You know, you're going to have Brooklyn and The Big Short and Room and Spotlight. Thank God they got some big commercial movies in there as well.
Right. And I think, you know, everybody's, I'm sure the Academy hopes Star Wars would get nominated so that a lot of people watched. I don't necessarily know that, you know, that's going to equate. One of the big snubs that everybody's talking about.
Well, I do. It tends to be years when there are big, big, big popular movies that are up for Oscar nominations. That's when you get bigger audiences. They actually recognize the movies that are nominated.
Yes.
That's why I think it helps that The Martian and Mad Max and The Revenant are on the list.
Okay. Well, one of the big snubs, as I was about to say, came in the directing category here. Ridley Scott, not nominated for The Martian. Everybody thought this was his year. He's going to be nominated and win.
Well, I didn't think that, and I don't think it's a snub because there are only five slots for director.
And
nine or ten for pictures, so there's always going to be somebody left off.
And they went to Adam McKay for The Big Short, George Miller for Mad Max Fury Road, Alejandro Iñárritu, who won this year for Birdman. He was nominated for The Revenant, Lenny Abramson from Room, Tom McCarthy for Spotlight. You think it's going to go to Tom McCarthy. I would say that that's probably a good bet. Iñárritu, if he wins a back-to-back Oscar, he would be the third person to ever have that happen to, joining John Ford.
This is where you get, you know, and?
Oh, I almost didn't go down that road because I couldn't remember the other person.
You mentioned
Billy
John
Wilder?
Ford.
Billy Wilder? I don't know. Who?
I don't think it's Billy Wilder, but I don't know. But here you go. All five nominees for director were also nominated for Best Picture, so nobody was snubbed. You know,
okay.
I mean, it's the way it happens. You know, if Todd Haynes had been nominated and somebody who was up for Best Picture didn't get a Best Director nod, okay. I mean, it sucks for Ridley Scott, of course. You know, he had a great commercial hit and you know, popular success. So I'm sure he's happy to be back on top in that sense.
I don't know who the other person. I'm looking it up now, and I can't find the other person. I cannot find the other back to back, but I know there's two others. I just don't know who they are.
Well, one you say is John Ford.
John Ford, yes. I don't know.
Keep looking. Best Actor, I think it's Leonardo DiCaprio's year. Best Actress, I think, is wide open. Best Supporting Actor, I'm just going to go with, you know, Spotlight, Mark Ruffalo. And Best Supporting Actress, again, I have no idea.
You don't think it's going to be Sylvester Stallone?
It could be, sure. Why not? I mean, you know, if it had been nominated for Best Picture and Best Director, I'd be more likely to think so. But yeah, I mean, those acting awards are always wild cards. Anything can happen there. They like to throw in they don't say, let me throw in something to shock you. I think, all right, skip the next 30 seconds if you haven't seen Creed. And go. I think if Stallone had died, he'd be more likely to win the Oscar. You know, if his character had died, then okay. If Rocky had died, and by God, my brother would have broken down in tears. I saw the movie with him. If he had died, yes, I think he'd have a better shot. But he didn't die. It's a formula movie. I think he's lucky to be nominated, and everybody's happy with that. And end scene.
You know, I think that maybe it was Joseph Mankiewicz. I don't know. I don't know who it was. Okay, I keep going back to, you know, trying to find this back-to-back. It may have been just John Ford, unless Mankiewicz directed. I've totally derailed this entire conversation to have it done.
You just don't know, do you?
Actually, I apologize. It was Joseph L. Mankiewicz in 1950.
For A Letter to Three Wives and All About Eve.
Correct. Yes. So there you go.
All right. Well, there you go. And two great movies.
Yes. Now, what do you think?
And what was John Ford nominated for? He was nominated for Grapes of Wrath and How Green Was My Valley back to back. Which he won for, rather.
Yes. Did you get to original screenplay? You said Spotlight, right?
I think Big Short and Spotlight will win the two screenplay awards.
Okay. Well, hey, Big Short. There's Charles Randolph, the old client.
There you go.
That's unbelievable. That's literal. I cannot believe that. I mean, look, he's a talented writer. Charles Randolph, Adam McKay, very talented. It's just one of those like, oh my gosh, I can't believe it.
Yeah. Well, and here we come to Best Animated Feature. And this brings us back to the Best Picture nominees. I think the five movies for Best Animated Feature are a good mix. You've got Inside Out. And then you've got the Charlie Kaufman film Anomalisa, which is certainly an adult, pushing the envelope on an animation film. Thankfully, happily, there's a lot you can do in animation, and most of it is just family oriented. So it's great to see them, you know, trying out new things and getting rewarded for it. And then you've got three smaller movies. They ignored like big movies like The Good Dinosaur and Peanuts, and they gave it to Boy in the World, Shaun the Sheep, the movie, and When Marnie Was There. So it's great to see those movies in the mix. I think they did a great choice of picking the best movies, perhaps. And that came out in animation rather than just the biggest movies. So that's cool to see. Obviously, Inside Out will win. But this is my problem. Why was Inside Out not nominated for Best Picture?
I think, again, it comes down to that weird math that they
It comes down to the fact that it's an animated movie. And just like, they just can't see themselves. You know, they don't like to nominate animated films for Best Picture. It's crazy. One of the biggest hits of the year. Easily one of the most acclaimed films of the year. And if you had a list with that on it and the best documentary film of the year and the best foreign film of the year in that mix for Best Picture, then you'd be looking at a really good list that would actually start to reflect the best movies of the year.
Well, best documentary, okay, we have Amy, about Amy Winehouse. Mm-hmm. Cartel Land, which is about the drug trade. The Look of Silence, which I'm not quite sure. Oh, is that the is Joshua Oppenheimer?
Yes.
Yeah. What Happened, Miss Simone, about Nina Simone, and Winter on Fire, Ukraine's Fight for Freedom. You say Amy. I say Cartel Land because Cartel. I mean, both Amy and the Nina Simone documentary were fantastic. Cartel Land, the guy was getting shot at. So hopefully he gets a little credit.
Well, my favorite of those five is The Look of Silence. That's a film about Indonesia and about the crimes against humanity that were committed in that country. It's a companion piece to The Act of Killing. It's a terrific film. I didn't even like Amy, but I just think, you know, it's going to win. They love movies about entertainment and anything can win. Look, you've got a bunch of noble movies about important issues. Cartel Land, Look of Silence, Winter on Fire. But I think Amy is just going to pull it off again, just like 20 Feet from Stardom.
Best foreign language film of the year. Let's face it, it's Son of Saul. Doesn't matter who else is nominated.
Well, let's hope so. I mean, this has not been a success at the box office, even by foreign film standards. It sort of came and went pretty quickly, but it's a terrific film, and it's from Hungary, by the way, and which we'll get to in a minute in the notes. But it's a great movie, and it's about the Holocaust. That's a winning formula when it comes to best foreign film. And again, if that had been up for Best Picture and Best Actor, as it well deserved to be, that would have made the list even better. And look at Best Documentary Films. It's sort of not a great list, frankly. I mean, you've got Frederick Weisman with In Jackson Heights, a great movie. The second film in a row that's really a late career masterpiece from one of the great documentary filmmakers of all time. And he's just completely overlooked.
Well, let's do one more category here because I think interesting. Achievement in cinematography. We have Ed Lachman for Carol, Robert Richardson, as you said, the guy who might not be liked because the ASC didn't nominate him.
there must be something going on.
Yeah, for The Hateful Eight. John Seale for Mad Max Fury Road, Emmanuel Lubezki for The Revenant, who won last year, and he's won for Gravity as well, Roger Deakins for Sicario, and that's it. You say The Hateful Eight, Robert Richardson. I would say it's either going to be Roger Deakins, who has been nominated numerous times, never won. Actually, or has he been nominated? I don't know, but he's never won. Ed Lachman for Carol, I think, may wind up winning here.
So you're not picking Lubezki for a triple play? He would win 3 years in a row, I believe. Wasn't Gravity 2 years ago?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so that would be a remarkable 3 years in a row. Cinematography is one of those areas that it can be anything. I go with the emotional, ode to 70 millimeter classic Hollywood. They already love Robert Richardson. Anything can happen. Sicario, I just saw the movie. I didn't really care for it, though I think the cinematography and the score are the two strong suits for that movie. Yeah, Carol's a great looking movie. They're all good looking movies. I mean, Mad Max Fury Road was one of my favorite films of the year. I haven't seen The Hateful Eight yet, but of the other four, Mad Max is the only one that would be on my best of the year list. So, you know, if I was choosing what I thought was the best shot movie for the best film of the year, it would probably be, you know, Mad Max out of those five.
Between 2008 and 2016, Roger Deakins has been nominated. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. This would be his seventh nomination between that time period. He only missed out on 2010 and 2012.
I don't think Sicario is the one that's going to put him over the
exactly.
top.
Exactly. I don't think so. He was nominated for True Grit, Skyfall, Prisoners, Unbroken, Sicario. You know, he's been nominated 12 times now. He shot The Shawshank Redemption. I mean, so a lot of people are like, okay, he's been nominated 12 times. When do you give it to him? Mm-hmm. I don't know whether this is the year.
Well, you know, again, when we're trying to figure out who's going to win the Oscar, we look at the other Guild Awards. The DGA nominations came out, and all their five movies, of course, are on the shortlist for Best Picture. The Big Short, Mad Max, The Martian, Revenant, and Spotlight. But Ridley Scott up for a DGA nomination, but he did not get up for an Oscar. So, again, that makes him seem even less likely to win the DGA award, right?
Well, I don't know, because Ben Affleck won the year that he was not nominated for Argo. He won the DGA award. So sometimes, because you're not nominated for Best Act,
they want to say, you were idiots. He should have been
correct.
Nominated, and we're going to give him the award.
Exactly.
It could happen.
Well, it would be a big deal if it did, don't you think?
Yes, it would be.
Which means it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, good morning, Baltimore. That beleaguered city could use some good news, and it arrived in the guise of a press release. NBC's next live musical will be Hairspray. The smash Broadway hit that is set in Baltimore begins with the song, Good Morning, Baltimore. I guess I should have sang that.
It should have been more like, Good Morning, Baltimore.
Right. It's based on the biggest hit film by Baltimore's number one son, director John Waters. Hey, it's better than, you know, more attention a la The Wire, right, I guess? No casting yet, though they'll be looking to cast an unknown as the lead and are not averse to the idea of John Travolta reprising his film turn as the mom. What about Harvey Fierstein, for Pete's sake? Big deal,
absolutely.
Big whoop.
I think it's a big whoop, of course, but NBC has turned their annual live musical into a tradition, I think. This will be the fourth year, and by God, you know, they're back on track. And that's a good choice.
Video games? A sport? Yes, it all falls under the umbrella of sports, at least as far as ESPN is concerned. Their audience plays video games and watches other people play video games and attend video game tournaments, and that means ESPN had to create a new vertical on its website to legitimize coverage. A special issue last May garnered a lot of ink and a lot of controversy when some ESPN regulars thought they'd lost their mind in devoting ink to video games. But now it's going to be a permanent part of the ESPN beat, Big Deal or Big Whoop.
I think it's a big deal.
I agree.
You know, I think it just, you know, that regular presence makes a big difference. Are they going into a territory that makes no sense? You know, I mean, they can cover chess. As far as I'm concerned, why not? You know, it's a game. People are competing at it. I think it makes sense. It'd be silly at this point to ignore it. You're just giving up that space to someone else, and I don't think it's too far afield from your main mission of people sweating it out on in a virtual, you know, in a physical space. Is it football, basketball, and baseball? No, but it's something that your audience sees in the same way as far as competition and competing and doing it themselves. Absolutely.
You know, for esports, League of Legends had this big tournament. They sold out Madison Square Garden, 17,000 or some odd tickets to watch. People play a video game.
Well, and Adele sold it out for 10 days in a row, but that doesn't mean you would cover Adele. The question is, it's popular, we know, but does it count as a sport? Does it make sense for ESPN to cover it? And I feel like it is.
Yeah. I mean, have you ever sat for 12 hours trying to play a video game? You need some athleticism there. You need to be in shape.
Yeah.
David Bowie has hit number one for the first time in his career. The late rock musician and rock innovator has reached the top of the Billboard charts. Always more influential than best-selling, Bowie's career is filled with critically acclaimed works, but very few platinum albums, and only one album that has sold 2 million copies. That would be his first great hit set, Changes One Bowie was the name of that. But with news of his death, the quietly selling black star exploded on the charts, selling 176 1,000 copies and displacing this hack, this has-been Adele at the top of the charts. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's a great way to close it out. You know, it's cool. It's fun. It doesn't mean anything in the long term, but it is great that when someone significant dies, people turn and they watch his videos, meaning not just the videos of his songs, but like Bowie on MTV talking about how they had a problem with race, which was a great early 80s clip that started to get a lot of attention.
It was in 1983, like, and he was basically like, hey, you know what, guys?
How come the only black people I see are on at 3 in the morning?
Right. And what I wanted to say is, how come you're up at 3 o'clock in the morning watching MTV? That's what I wanted to know.
He's a rock star. Yeah. What do you mean, why? He should be up at 3 in the morning. So it's very cool that people are listening to his music in his new album and a lot of his great albums like Aladdin Sane and Ziggy Stardust and you name it. There's so much great music to listen to.
Well, and think about it. The Breakfast with the Beatles, the only time they've ever not played the Beatles is this past weekend when they played David Bowie instead.
Oh, well, that was very cool. Nice tip of the hat. And speaking of tips of the hat, the Paz and Jop poll is out. You know, Black Star came out too late to be considered for this year. Perhaps it'll be in the running next year. It certainly is getting good reviews. But Kendrick Lamar, to nobody's surprise, won the Paz and Jop poll from Village Voice with his album To Pimp a Butterfly. And it's certainly a contender for Album of the Year at the Grammys in February.
And Paz and Jop used to be a great blog. And I guess now it's just a list. They don't really publish, you know, new posts every day. But they have this great list every year of some of the best music from the previous year.
I don't know about it being a blog or not, but I mean, they have their usual commentary with the list.
Okay,
I mean,
that's good.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think they did it a week. I mean, if it was a blog, it's only been the last few years.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's a great list. Go check it out. We'll place a link to it in the show notes.
All right.
With TV execs meeting with journalists this past week, the TCA, the Television Critics Association, a flurry of announcements about new shows and new seasons took place, including everything from a Prison Break revival. Seems very unlikely to the teaser.
It's happening.
I know. It just seems like, where are they getting it?
Could it be back in jail? I know. It should be new people.
I know. It has to be because, well,
it's not.
It literally has to be. I mean, you understand why it has to be, right? Without ruining anything for people.
I've not watched season 4 or whatever of Prison Break, so I have no idea why it has to be. All I know, it's the same actors.
Okay. Be like, well, I'm not going to ruin anything else. Okay. Well, they also teased the possibility of Freaks and Geeks returning, which made no sense until you clicked on the headline promising Judd Apatow saying anything is possible to then actually reading the story and finding out that no, it's not happening at all. Among the more notable announcements, Netflix is going to create a scripted series around the YouTube character Miranda Sings. Miranda Sings. She is the fictional star of her own channel, her own YouTube channel, who is convinced she's famous, even though no one else knows it yet. Also, Fox is going ahead with the iconic series 24, but without Jack Bauer. Yes, the world-weary agent will get to relax while a new young recruit is put through the ringer of one horrific day wherein they must save the world, or at least the U.S., from a terrorist plot. We like to call that Wednesday. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. Show gets green light. But, you know, there's a lot of news coming out and it makes, you know, it's interesting. It's fun. It lets us know what's going to be happening in the weeks and months down the road. On 24, all I can say is, you know what? Don't make 24 episodes. You keep the hour format. Absolutely. You know, 1 hour equals 1 hour of real time. Absolutely. But his day can end after 16 hours.
Or better yet, make, you know, an hour and a half, you know, make, you know, do something. Yeah, I agree.
I'm just saying, no, I keep the real time thing, but like it can be from, you know, 6 at night to, you know, 10 a.m. the next day or whatever. But, like, you do not have to have 24 episodes because it's just too many. You know, make whatever episodes make sense. Keep the time frame of the real time thing. But if it should be 17 episodes or 14, let it be that. It doesn't have to be, you know, you can have action and it all end in 12 or 14 episodes. Nobody will get upset that there aren't 24 episodes. The real time clock matters, but do not feel the need to make 24 episodes.
Well, and this haters back off thing. That could have been done a feature on this, because what's really interesting to me, Miranda Sings, who I have to say my kids introduced me to. OK, so I know
I'm not familiar with her at all.
Yeah, I know I'm old. It's basically an actress with this red lipstick and, you know, she talks with a really nasally
voice. And she's making fun of all the people online who think they should be famous.
Right. And now she is famous and now that character is getting their own show. But note how to legitimize herself or not, or to be a legitimate hit, she had to go to mainstream media, or in this case streaming media. Like, she had to get off of YouTube to be the big success.
No. She has 5.7 million subscribers. 700 million views.
That yeah, so what you're saying, this is just kind of a tributary to her success.
It's a next logical step, but I think she's probably making six figures a year, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, she's probably making, you know, she's one of those rare people making money off YouTube, but she's making six figures a year. I don't think she, you know, and now she's going to Netflix, which now you're saying is mainstream, which a minute ago you were saying nobody's going to give Netflix an Oscar nomination. They don't even count. So, you know, 10 minutes ago, Netflix wasn't mainstream.
I was saying there was a perception issue. We'll get to that in a moment. But let me ask you this, Michael. You go to Broadway all the time, right? Have you ever seen Today Ticks?
Oh, absolutely. Those are the people who stand out front of a theater. You get the tickets online via their app, and they're out front with a little Today Ticks t-shirt or cap. And, you know, you've paid for the tickets, and they're there meeting you, some volunteer who probably gets to go see a volunteer. I don't know what they get paid. But they probably get to go see shows every once in a while and get some, you know, crappy pay. But there they are with the envelopes, and you identify yourself, and they give you the tickets that you bought via the app.
And so then you find
go on
out-
that day, you find cheap ticket, you show up at the theater, and they're there. So it avoids the whole lining up in the morning at the beloved TDF booth. So it's a sort of a new way of doing that.
Well, and if you read the New York Times today, you kind of avoid buying a counterfeit ticket to Hamilton, apparently.
That's right. There's a lot of fake Hamilton tickets. Broadway doesn't get a ton of fake tickets, but with a show like this or Book of Mormon, where the attention is so big, it's worthwhile for people to create counterfeit tickets. So yeah, you want to buy it from TDF or Today Ticks or the box office. Do not go to like some guy on the street.
Well, Today Ticks released an end of the year roundup of their data. The app for theatergoers looking for cheap tickets, as you just explained, Michael, or lotteries, announced it was accessed tens of millions of times, though 9 million of that might have been people, as you say, hoping to find tickets to the musical Hamilton. Good luck. They said their users are, quote, not surprisingly, younger and more tech savvy than most Broadway fans, with Today Ticks users averaging 30 years old. That's their average age. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, I guess.
Yeah.
But you know, I wish TDF had done it, or I'm glad that the Broadway people are making access to this. You shouldn't have to get in line at 9 in the morning physically. It's dumb. I mean, I understand the solidarity of it and the coolness of it once upon a time, but you got all these lotteries at these shows, you know. Make it easy for people who are here. They're going to have to go up and show up and be there 2 minutes before the show. So, you know, there's no reason to force them to line up 2 hours early just to get a chance at a cheap ticket. You know, make it a little easier for them. Use technology smartly. And I think that's what they're doing.
Well, and maybe if, you know, people started using apps like this, crossing the street by the TKTS booth in Times Square over there by 46th Street would be a lot easier, since there wouldn't be that cram of people. In any case, speaking of tickets, if you are looking to score Hamilton tickets, you'd be smarter to use a trusted service like Today Ticks or Live Nation, as we just mentioned. In fact, last year, Live Nation says it sold 29 million tickets to concerts and events around the world. That makes them the number one ticket seller by a mile, selling twice as many tickets as AEG, which says it sold about 15 million tickets. Way below them are ticket companies based around the world, like Ireland's MCD, Germany's Marek, Lieberberg. I'm not even...
Concert Agentur.
Okay, you said it, not me. Mexico's Zignia, South America's Time for Fun, and so on. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, I guess. I mean, the bigger get bigger, right? You can see how exponentially larger Live Nation and AEG are compared to everybody else.
Well, when you own the
that's
venues...
That's always a concern, right?
Yeah, when you own the venues, you get to sell the tickets, and that's basically what's happening there.
There you go.
Al Jazeera America. Remember them? We actually talked about when Current TV was going to be taken over by Al Jazeera America, and now they're shutting down the 24-hour...
Ah, there goes my chance at another job.
Yeah, well, that's... 24-hour news channel that provides a rare, somewhat independent voice in the Middle East always seemed a quixotic bet for the crowded U.S. market, and now it's shutting down. The channel continues to expand worldwide, but won't have a footprint here in America, at least not on cable. Their website will continue to be available, and Al Jazeera argues that since news has gone digital, that's all that really matters anyway. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I'm going to say a big whoop, and I think in a way they're right, you know, because it's easier to set up a cable website. You can reach the entire world right away. UDC, CNN, and FoxNews.com having a huge digital presence. So yeah, if they want to be a presence here in the U.S., it's nice if they have the boots on the ground and the actual reporters getting paid to do coverage, but they can reach people via a website just as easily as getting a channel placed on a bunch of cable stations all around the country.
And you know who was particularly pleased about this?
Who's that?
Peyton Manning.
Well, he would have been happier if it shut down 4 weeks ago.
That's true. We should explain to international listeners that Peyton Manning is a quarterback for the Denver Broncos, and Al Jazeera America broke a news story that he was several years ago when he was trying to make a comeback. He may have been taking some performance-enhancing drugs, surprising absolutely no one.
Which he angrily denies.
Yes. Sometimes a movie storyline can prove timely. Surely the Danish girl wasn't hurt by tackling gender reassignment surgery just as the world was getting used to Caitlyn Jenner. But sometimes a movie can be too timely. That's the case with Made in France. This new French drama tackled homegrown jihadists planning strikes on downtown Paris. Instead of getting a theatrical release, it's been dropped by one distributor and picked up by another that plans to take the film straight to video on demand. And this is a quote from Pretty Pictures, one of the distributors. "I think it's the grown-up decision," they said. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I guess it's a big whoop. If it was a really good movie, you know, then I would feel sorry for it. I don't know what the reviews are like or what kind of movie it is. You know, if they'd come out a few weeks earlier than it, it would have been, you know, to its benefit. They're not trying to benefit off tragedy. But, you know, if it's worthwhile seeing, it's a shame that it's sort of getting lost in the shuffle. But if you want to see, I haven't seen this movie, but I do know a good British film sort of about the same territory, and it's a comedy. You may not be ready for that if you're in France, but if you're elsewhere, Four Lions, a 2010 British film about four incompetent British jihadis who set out to commit an act of terror, is actually a really good movie and well worth checking out.
Very good movie, yes. I remember seeing that. I can't remember the festival, but very good movie. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we kind of lucked out. We picked Netflix as our Inside Baseball topic, and then we woke up in the morning and apparently so did the LA Times and the New York Times. Everybody's talking about how Hollywood and the studios and the networks are afraid of how big Netflix is becoming.
And I'm not sure I agree.
What?
Well, I don't know. I mean, they say, is Netflix too big? A quote from the research president, Alan Wurzel at NBC Universal, says, quote, "Every single day in my company, and I know in other companies, there's a question of, did we do something to build a monster that will come back to kill us?" And I understand that concern. And other people talking about, hey, look, cable, you know, cable subscriptions going down, ESPN having a lower subscriber base, Netflix just gets bigger and bigger. But to me, they just seem quite vulnerable. You know, most of their audience is watching this big library that they have, and that costs a lot of money, right? I mean, they're a big revenue stream for studios, and if they're not willing to pay, they're not going to get the programming, right?
Yes, and certainly that's been proven time and again. What's really kind of beginning to spook people is, okay, that's true. You're absolutely right, Michael. Everything you just said is true. However, they've been making all this money based on our content and our libraries, and now
As have we, but
now they're turning around and they're also a competitor now because they have 600 hours of programming in 2016, which is right up there with a broadcast network or a cable network's primetime schedule.
So, how is that different from HBO? They pay studios for movies. They were the big kahuna at one point, and then they build up their library of original programming, and perhaps movies are less important to them now. They still show a lot of movies. They probably pay less than they used to because they're not the big player, so they don't have to pay top dollar because I'm sure they pay a premium good price, but they are not, you know, the big 800-pound gorilla. So, you know, there they are. They're creating programming that's competitive. They're also a buyer, which everybody's happy to have them pay them money. Why aren't they scared of HBO?
Well, with HBO, it's called an output deal, okay? So, in other words, you sign a long-term agreement, and the studio gets a letter saying, okay, we will play all of your content and we will pay you based on your box office, etc. So you can go to a bank and get funding. I mean, it's a whole complicated financing strategy there.
And Netflix pays billions of dollars a year for programming too, right? What's the difference?
Well, in this case, and by the way, it did become more complicated for HBO. When they started making their own original content, they started to cannibalize what the studios and networks were capable of producing. The same thing is happening here, because producers who don't have to worry about ratings over at Netflix are taking
or HBO
are taking projects to Netflix first and HBO first, mostly Netflix. Now, it used to be that the TCAs, these Television Critics Association meetings they're in the summer and then again in January.
This doesn't explain to me why. I mean, Netflix is a buyer just like ABC, CBS, NBC and Fox and the CW. And about a couple hundred cable channels, and Netflix and HBO are in that mix too. Do you want to be on HBO and Netflix? Sure. Do you want to be on CBS or NBC or Fox? Sure.
Yeah, but you can only be, in other words, if you're going to take a television show or a movie to somebody to produce it, you can only be on one. Somebody's going to produce it. It will be CBS or it will be Netflix.
Yeah, they're both competitors and they will collaborators.
Correct.
They will buy your library, but they will also compete with you for projects.
Correct.
Okay, big deal.
And by the way,
so how is that
HBO
making Netflix
and Netflix
any difference from FX and HBO and CBS?
Well,
it's not. CBS does movies. CBS has original programming, right?
Yes, and you know what? What FX would say about CBS? They're a competitor. We don't sell any content to them. They are a competitor. Okay, they would not say, and so now...
Well, but that's not true for most studios, because most studios will have programming on their own channel, and they will also sell programming to others. So if FX has a great show, and for some reason they don't want it on their channel, but the CW wants to buy it, why wouldn't they sell it to them?
Most
studios create programming, and they will put it on their own network, but they'll also sell it to anybody else.
That's, yes.
And everybody's in business with everybody else. What is different about Netflix?
Netflix is
big,
and they're making money for the studios on their library, but they're becoming so big that they can begin to sit
in
the
catbird seat. But who cares if they're also a player making original programming? Why is that such a horrible thing? Why is that a scary thing?
Because
there are 100 other companies.
Right, but you have one more powerful player. You've basically created a monster.
Why are they a monster? They're paying you billions of dollars a year.
Because
for your
if I could pay Steven Spielberg today $1 million to direct a movie for me, and he's going to bring that movie to me 100% of the time, okay? And 2 years from now, I'm feeding content to somebody who's making now A, more money than me, and B, can afford to pay Steven Spielberg $2 million to take the content directly to Netflix and directly to the person I used to be a supplier to. Then I don't get the content. I'm not making the money. I mean, it's basically...
Well, Netflix is the cute kid on the block, and so people like think it's fun to be on Netflix, but I don't see that, like, you know, and HBO is a quality player, but AMC is a quality player. FX is a quality player, you know. I mean, people like to be on AMC, right?
Yes, although I like what Dana Walden had to say.
People are not bringing to AMC because they want to be on Netflix? I don't think so.
You'd be shocked, actually. Yes.
Well, I don't know. I see AMC is a buyer. I want to be AMC. I want to be on HBO. I want to be on CBS at 10 o'clock following, you know, whatever their biggest hit is of the moment. You know, I don't see, you know, it's one more player. And in fact, when they have to compete with everybody else for time, you know, that means it's less money they can spend on the library, or the library means they can spend less money. You know, it's like they got to balance it out. It ain't easy.
Well, I like what Dana Walden had to say. She said, Netflix has been built on the back of great content from studios like our own. And she is the head of Fox Television Group.
She's also described Turner Classic Movies and AMC and HBO and 1,000 other channels on cable and TV and streaming.
She says it has helped reinvigorate fan bases of shows. But from the network side, it's very challenging. They're a competitor. Now,
so is AMC.
Let me
so
finish.
Is TCM,
let me finish.
So is HBO.
She points to the Breaking Bad effect, okay, to illustrate how Netflix can be both a friend and a foe. The AMC drama, of course, as you know, Michael, you mentioned AMC. It was on for 4 seasons. Then it was on Netflix. Everybody found it on Netflix. Then the 5th season, 6th season, 7th season, they started to become bigger and bigger because people had discovered it on Netflix and went to AMC to watch it. However, the show is associated, Breaking Bad, that is, with Netflix, not AMC.
Bullshit. That is ridiculous. Nobody associates Breaking Bad with Netflix. It's AMC. No, that is absurd.
I don't know.
No, that is ridiculous. A, it grew every single season. It wasn't just the fifth season where, or fourth season where it began to grow. It grew every year bigger than the year before. And that is an AMC show. They have the sequel, Better Call Saul. They have The Walking Dead. Nobody says, oh, that Netflix show Breaking Bad. And it doesn't matter if people say CBS, NBC, ABC. It matters that they go watch your show, which is what they did on AMC. That is stupid. And now you're talking about perception rather than dollars and cents.
But that's actually...
Breaking Bad is a show. It benefited from being rebroadcast on Netflix. Great. Everybody won. Other shows benefit from being seen on Hulu or on the networks, or they benefit from a DVR. It doesn't matter.
Well, perception is actually part of the problem here, okay? And according to the industry, because what they're saying is Netflix is running around saying, we're successful. We're successful. We're the biggest success since we're bigger than cable channels. And you know what NBC and Fox and all these companies are saying, these other networks are saying, you know what, prove it.
No fair. Tell us what your ratings are. But they don't care what their ratings are.
They don't
care. Why should Netflix have to reveal, it doesn't even, ratings don't even make sense for them. They don't have a time slot. They don't have a thing. You want to know how many people watch their show? Sure, I do too. But why should they? HBO never did it for years.
Yes,
and that infuriated people.
Yes, and it's infuriating now. And I agree that they should not have to report numbers if they, if they don't want to. The only numbers they really have to report are
to their investors.
Subscriber numbers, right. And
they don't have to report anything, do they? I mean, what's the law?
Well, they don't have to. But I would say that you
get... If they're making money, who cares?
I would say that you get your ratings when they renew or don't renew a show. You know whether it's successful. But here's what John Landgraf is saying and Alan Wurzel is saying. Look, you don't get to have it both ways. You don't get to say you're really successful based on the numbers and then not report those numbers.
Well, they don't claim that they have gazillion people. They just say we're a success. We're happy with how
the show's
doing.
No, that's not true. That is not true. They actually, Ted Sarandos is running around saying, you know, we get as many, like we would, you know, bigger than a network show or bigger than a cable show. He's out there saying that the shows are really popular and have millions and millions of viewers. So NBC comes out. Alan Wurzel, who's the president of research.
It wasn't NBC. It was a San Francisco company. They quoted a company. Again, everybody says NBC did this. They didn't do it.
They commissioned
a company in San Francisco called Symphony Advanced Media, did some half-assed data gathering and claims to have some numbers on Netflix viewership.
Well, no. NBC Universal paid for it. Okay, that's why.
That's fine, but NBC pays Nielsen, but NBC doesn't do the ratings. Nielsen does. They pay Nielsen, and Nielsen is the one responsible for it, not NBC. So NBC did not do these numbers. It's Symphony Advanced Media, and it sounds like a half-assed sampling of 15,000 people where they claim to have numbers. And frankly, the numbers sounded pretty damn good to me. they said, what was the numbers that they came out with?
Based on audio recognition data, and by the way, the reason
this is all malarkey.
And the reason NBC Universal is getting credit for this is because they commissioned the study. Okay.
So what?
So
yes, I know. They announced the thing. They said they paid a company to do a study to try to get some numbers on Netflix. And then they said, oh, Jessica Jones,
4.8 million
was seen by 3.9 million people, adults age 18 to 49, to which I say, well, that sounds pretty damn good. Jessica Jones was watched by 4.2 million people in the 18 to 49 demo. Well, wow, that sounds pretty great. Sounds like they're backing it up.
Well, and I guess what they're looking at it from is a network point of view. They know what makes a successful show. What
And 4.2 million viewers of 18 to 49 would be a successful network show.
And I would not call 15,000 user study or a sampling.
Well, that's small. That's probably larger than Nielsen uses.
That's what I mean. So I get...
But the technology and the methodology sounded kind of weird.
No, well, no, that's the way Nielsen has been, you know, doing their...
No, I'm not saying the numbers. What matters, of course, first is the mix of people. But this audio recognition data to track what... It's bizarre, you know. Nielsen has people writing down what they say they saw. They have a machine, technology watching what they saw. This is some weird audio recognition data to sample what they hear in the air. They think they've heard the audio sampling of the beginning of a show, and therefore they decide you watched it.
Right, but they can actually track when you fast-forwarded, when you paused. They can do it. Look, let's not get into methodology here.
Well, why are we bringing it up? The point is they paid a company to do some bizarro sampling to claim certain numbers, and they tout them as if they're terrible. They sound pretty good to me.
Yeah, no, and I think that I think that they are saying, hey, they're pretty good. They come all what they've actually discovered is, hey, when a Netflix show is on the air or is premiered, there's a huge burst of activity, kind of like an opening weekend, so to speak, where a lot of people are binge watching and then it falls off gradually over the next weeks. Whereas our shows stay in the conversation for, you know, months at a time. And what
that just gets into the question of how you release a show and whether it's better to do it all at once or, you know, over the weeks, et cetera.
Yeah. And you have, you know, John Landgraf, who is of too much television fame. Remember, he at the last TCA said there's too much television on the air, and he agrees, actually. So
with what?
And he said the same thing again this time around. He said it's going to be about the same, maybe a little bit more. In 2016,
the amount of TV that's out there. Well, yeah, there's not going to be, everybody's not going to fall off all off the map. They're not going to suddenly stop making TV shows.
Look, here's what I think everybody's trying to say with these news stories is that, and that, by the way, we talked about this. You and I and guests have talked about this in the past. Okay, when HBO said, "Look, don't tell me you're not a competitor of mine," and then steal content from me, and by content I mean, whether it's
don't pay for shows that I wish I had.
Correct. Don't tell me you're not a competitor, and then you know you get the streaming rights to Jurassic World, or you get the broadcast rights.
They're
to
a competitor. I'm happy to say that. I don't care.
And what the networks are saying is, look, you keep saying you're successful based on all these figures, and so the perception is that you are successful, but you can't say that unless you're actually going to give us the numbers. And here are the numbers. And yes, you know what? You're up there. For, you know, a good cable network, you'd be, you know, you're pretty good for a good cable network. You're not beating the broadcast networks, and you're not getting 30 million
people. Well, based on this one study, that is of question, you know, of
well,
whatever.
I wouldn't necessarily question the study because it's the
Why
same.
Why not? I don't know anything about how it was done. It sounds weird. It sounds half-assed, and it's a one-time thing, and it's really hard to track TV viewing, and it's got to be exponentially harder to track Netflix viewing because it doesn't happen Tuesday at 8. It happens. You know, I might 2 months from now decide to watch Masters of None. I want to watch Masters of None. I haven't done it yet. But tracking that is not easy. And it doesn't happen in a day or a week or a month. And they don't care if you start to watch Masters of None 4 months from now, as long as you keep paying your bill.
That's true. That's absolutely true.
Right. And the question whether it's success, they're a success if they make money.
And you know,
if people pay for Netflix and they're happy with the service, even if the library gets cut in half, but they're happy enough with the original programming that it's worth their $10 a month, then it's a success.
That I agree with. I completely agree with, because you know what? If they're making a show and I say all of a sudden, you know what? I don't want to pay $10. What am I going to watch on Netflix? Then they say, okay, the shows we're making aren't working because they're not keeping our subscribers around.
Exactly.
And that's what really matters. I do think the perception of saying you're so successful and not having to back it up with anything, it just goes to show you how easy it is to kind of spin a perception into, yeah, we're really big.
I don't think it's perception. They've got critically acclaimed shows and they've got a strong subscriber base and they're spending a lot of money on a library and they're spending a lot of money to make original programming.
And they're getting a lot of ink and a lot of press. And I think that's where perception really plays. For instance, if I said Making a Murderer, okay, you'd say, right, oh, that's a Netflix show in which, you know, Stephen Avery, and you'd tell me what it was about because it's getting so much ink and so much coverage.
You mean like Mad Men, a show that was never a popular success, even remotely? And yet got more articles written per episode than any show in TV history.
Precisely.
And lots of Emmy love.
Precisely.
You know, that's a show, talk about perception, that put AMC on the map. It doesn't, you know, success comes in a lot of forms. That show is very profitable for them. That show put them, you know, helped them launch The Walking Dead and Breaking Bad and all these other shows. Not a big popular success, but it made money. And that's what matters. And they could afford to run it for 6 or 7 years because it made them a lot of money all over the world. But it wasn't because of the big ratings.
Now, speaking of perception, okay, I first met Alan Rickman when he was doing theater. He passed away last week at the age of 69 due to cancer. And everybody...
Just like Bowie.
Just like David Bowie. Everybody talked about, of course, one role. Well, a couple roles. Two roles. His role as the villain in Die Hard, of course. And naturally, his roles as Sirius Snape in the Harry Potter franchise.
True. Well, that's the power of movies.
Exactly. So the perception is, no, he really hit the mark when he did that Harry Potter. Well, no, he was acting for eons before that.
Yeah, no. I mean, you know, he was terrific in Sense and Sensibility. He was good in Truly, Madly, Deeply. He had some other good films, but he's probably even better success on stage, like Liaison Dangereux. That was his really big stage triumph, but also Private Lives and some other roles. He went back and forth. You know, he had a nice, lovely career.
And whenever I talked to him and met him, it was socially. I don't think I ever met him professionally, but he was always incredibly nice. But that voice, that deep voice, I mean, it was just so natural. I mean, obviously it was his voice, but you know, it was great to just listen to him talk. Unlike us, where it's not so great to listen to us talk, apparently.
Well, I hope so. Well, my goodness, if not, we're in trouble.
Yeah, well, you know.
It's nice to hear our readers talk, isn't it?
Yes. In fact, we have two emails here. I don't know how you want to handle this first one from James Gardner in Australia. Do you want to read it, Michael? Do you want me to?
He's weighing in on The Hateful Eight.
That's right.
He says, I've been rather amazed at the amount of media covering the 70mm film debate coming from the release of The Hateful Eight. There seems to be a lot of critical argument on whether this kills or saves film. Being in Hollywood, what is the impression in the industry after all this?
And he's asking us.
Yeah, to which I would say, well, there's no debate. It's not saving film. It can't save film. Film is dead.
Yeah, I mean,
people can still make something like this happen when you have a lot of power, but even this movie has mostly been seen in digital.
Yeah, and he goes into, you know, how even if you shoot on film, you have to make a digital intermediate, which would be at a 2K or 4K resolution, which means when you go back to 70mm, what resolution are you going at? I don't know. I can't answer any of that.
Well, that's cool. But he says this makes it highly likely the 70mm copy would be struck from a 4K master. And so going from 4K to 70mm film would obviously still not match the quality of the digitally projected 4K master DCP. So he's saying, you know what? You may even get a better quality if you look at it on the digital print. My point would be not the fact of how many lines of resolution, but what's the most beautiful to look at, you know? Something may be in a scratchy, you know, visual whatever that's less pristine, but it may be more beautiful and more aesthetically pleasing. That's the whole point. It's not what gives you the most pixels, but what gives you the most beautiful art.
Right. And I actually reached out to James to do a story on this for Celluloid Junkie, but I would go back to answer his question directly, to what Ed Lachman, now nominated for an Academy Award for Carol, when he was in Cannes, what he said was, you know how hard it is these days to find a camera operator or assistant camera operator who actually knows how to load a film magazine or deal with film.
Because it doesn't happen.
Yeah, it's so hard.
Well,
and
of course.
So what does this mean for film? It's still, you have people, craftspeople, who don't know how to work with it.
Of course not.
And so, I mean, that's the
issue. Sure, there are photographers, fashion photographers, who don't know how to, you know, take a film negative and put it in a bath and make it, you know, print. It's because they don't do that.
Well, it's like when I said to my daughter, she asked, you know, what I studied in college. And I said, well, I went to film school. Her response, what's film? So,
well, that's a word that also means movies. So you should raise her better.
Okay. But he ends with saying, she was six at the time. So cut her some slack.
All right. So James Gardner ends with the question, is the use of 70mm for projection more of a marketing hype machine than reality? I wouldn't say it was marketing hype so much as a burst of nostalgia or a desire to not let go of something that has its own unique aesthetic qualities. But yes, it is in fact gone for good.
Yes.
Other than, you know, some museum thing, some special event like this, that era sadly has passed.
We also have an email from Greg. He writes, hi, Michael and Sperling. Just thought that you might be interested in this little clipping from the Hungarian news about Star Wars. Hungary reports both revenue and admissions for the films shown here, and the information is made available to all exhibitors so that they know how they are positioned against their competitors. Interesting concept that would make your reporting a whole lot easier.
So Hungary, like South Korea? Is it South Korea that reports admissions?
South Korea only reports admissions. They don't report dollar figures.
Right. So Hungary also includes admissions along with revenue. So that's very cool. Were you able to check out the information on Star Wars?
I did, and I did it about a week ago when this email first came in, and I haven't looked again. So I'm going to have to go back and look at it.
Oh, because I tried to, and all I got was Hungarian. Was it in English?
Not that I know of. That's a good question.
Oh, okay. So that was very cool. Well, if you speak Hungarian, we'll include that in the show notes. But yes, it's very neat that they report admissions. That should have happened about 80 years ago if we really wanted a good record for admissions. And you know, who was it? Paul Dare Garabedian said, people love money. But you know what? You say 10 million people went to see our movie. I think that's a number people can understand. You know, it's just as vivid to me as saying, you know, we made $40 million at the box office. Saying 10 million people went to see the movie, 8 million people went to see the movie. I think that has impact too. But just like 70 millimeter film, that era never even began in Hollywood.
Well, I can tell you historically, one of the reasons they didn't report admissions was due to, again, we go back to this word, perception. And it was Denzel Washington who taught me this. And it was Sidney Poitier who taught him this. Sidney Poitier told Denzel Washington very early in his career, he was on St. Elsewhere, a television show. He was told, listen, if you are on television and you're on a great show, if they get you for free on Thursday, they're not going to pay to see you on Saturday. And he learned that more people will watch the number 1 through 10 television shows in America, and that this was in the 90s, okay, then will actually go see the number 1 movie in total. So that number 1 movie in the course of its theatrical run, more people will watch the Thursday night hourly drama than will ever see that movie in theaters. So he realized, okay, I'm going to have to pull back from doing television if I want to just focus on movies. That's not so true anymore. But,
that's not true at all.
And so historically, what the issue was originally, in part, was that the numbers were so skewed that it made it look like a film wasn't successful, even though it was making a ton of money. So they said, let's go with dollar figures.
That's not true, because we're talking about the 20s and the 30s when third of the country went to the movies every week.
No.
That's
I'm talking about the 70s, 80s,
and 90s.
That's
not when it happened. It happened back in the 20s and 30s. That's when the tradition of reporting, you know, it had nothing to do with the 70s and the 80s. It began back in the day.
Oh, well, let's not argue about
this. Right? I mean, when did Hollywood start reporting box office? And by the way, that isn't true for St. Elsewhere, because that was always more of a critical acclaimed hit than a popular hit. It's a great show. But it aired in the early 80s, 82 to 87, and Denzel was on that show for a number of years, and a great TV drama, but certainly not a big hit. That was one of the first shows to stay on the air because of its demos, because the audience that watched it was wealthy and educated, and advertisers valued it, and NBC was able to sell it to them and say, hey, look, we're not getting big numbers, but every single person watching this show has got a lot of money, and you want to reach them. And that became a way they could keep that show on the air for 6 seasons.
And so, that's exactly what we tell our sponsors.
That's right. Our audience is smart. You know, we keep begging them to rate and review our show. You know what the problem is, Sperling?
What's that?
They're powerful, important Hollywood players.
That's
powerful,
true.
Important players all over the world in the entertainment business. It's clear that a lot of our audience are players in the film and entertainment industry. And what we should be saying to them is, no, we don't want to bother you. Tell your assistant to rate and review our show. Tell your assistant to, you know, get on iTunes, for God's sakes. Not only do you get to help us, but you also get to order your assistant around. What could be more fun than that?
Yes, and, you know, if you do want to order us around, you can do so by doing exactly what Greg and James did. They emailed dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And when you do boss your assistants around and tell them to go subscribe to the show and rate and review the show, they can do it in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. And we appreciate it when you do rate and review the show in any one of those podcast aggregators. All of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. Showbizsandbox.com is our website. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is MGMT.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's Spike, can I come to your house to watch the Oscars.com.
And the answer is sure, I'm home.com. Oh my goodness. You know, I forgot to mention, by the way, that you can follow us on Twitter @ShowbizSandbox or like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up. Now, some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.